Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. But just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. Let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me. Need a little help, y'all. Yes, I do. Need a little help. Say it, boy. Need some help, y'all. Change the world. What it used to be. Can't do it alone.
Can't do it alone.
Need some help, yeah.
Need some help, yeah.
That's right. Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in the bed. Wake up, wake up, wake up, and put some in your head. Welcome to MPH Radio, Missing Pages of History. As your voice on MPH Radio today, we're going to discuss this important crisis, some say, that's going on in the U.S. and throughout the world, really. But in the context of the U.S. border, we're going to discuss the crisis of the immigration game. What is this game? What is going on? We'll have an open discussion on this particular topic today. And we'd like to hear your voice by calling in at 818-337-0016. So before we begin this topic, like always, our agenda for today is we're going to give you something to think about as it relates to freedom. We're going to give you a Black Men's Act, LPH from Susie. Then we'll have a statement, a message to the community from Brother Alex. We'll have an opening discussion on that theme along with a special message and poem from our sister Mary. That will be our order for the day. As time, at this particular time, let's begin to speak to the powerful and the powerless, and represent those underserved communities whose voices are not being heard. So this is the voice of MPH Radio. At this point in time, we're going to give you something to think about, and that something to think about is freedom. What is freedom? Freedom is something often thought about, died over, and I think it's important for us to get a better collective understanding of what freedom is. Once we understand what freedom is, then we'll know how to go about getting it. I will just give you a general definition of freedom, and you tell me what you think about this concept and how does it fit into your life. We said freedom is having the ability and means to control those necessities for life. That is, freedom is having the ability and means control those necessities for life. What do y'all think about that particular concept of freedom? That's to give you a little something to think about as we continue to celebrate African History Month. At this time, we're going to make our transition to Sister Susie, and she's going to share with you something about our MPH Black Benefactor for this particular month. Sister Susie, we'd like to welcome you to MPH, and the mic is yours.
I could be coming from today the Black Benefactor will be coming from the PRSP calendar of 2021. Each generation must, out of relative obscurity, discover its mission, fulfill it or betray it. For Nas Famine was a psychoanalyst and social philosopher known for his writings on behalf of the national liberation of colonial people. He was educated in France in medicine and psychiatry at the University of Lyon. In 1953 to 1956, he served as the head of psychiatry department of Bladder Joinville Hospital in Algiers, then a French colony. He began organizing with the Algerian Liberation Movement, the FLN. His seminal work with the Wretched of the Earth, published shortly after his death in 1961, established him as the leading intellectual in the international decolonization movement. I've just given you the Black Minifile for today, Saturday, the 17th of 2024. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan, for your MPH Black Benefactor. For this particular month, what we're going to do right now, we're going to take a quick station break with music with a purpose, music with a message, and when we come back, we're going to have Brother Alex speaks to the community. You're listening to MPH Radio.
Show them all the beauty they possess.
That's right. It's all right to find your strength in any creator as well as the people, the almighty people. We welcome you back to MPH Radio. And what we're going to do right now, we're going to bring a message to the community by bringing in my co-host, Brother Alex. He's going to share with you a message to the community, and we will follow that with a live discussion on the immigration game. We have special guests, John Standback and Sister Nanya. So we want you who listen to this program today to call in at 817-318-337-0016 to give your point of view on this important issue as we discuss this immigration game that is coming up. But right now, we have a message to the community from Brother Alex. We're going to bring him in, and we'd like to welcome Brother Alex to MPH. Welcome, Brother Alex.
Well, thank you, Brother Lee, for giving me this opportunity to speak to the community again. Thank you for bringing the panelists we'll be listening today. And Susie, always, you know where my heart lies. So I would like to say that the 1956 bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama, proved a success, and the civil rights movement began to set their sights on other areas of segregation that were present in America. Negroes had been treated as second-class citizens in jobs, justice, education, health care, finance, travel, and dining establishments. They had endured so many hardships and had little faith in the laws being passed by the United States Congress. They believed that it was a one-sided system of justice for the privileged and the wealthy citizens of the country. The Brown versus Board of Education decision stopped school segregation, but Jim Crow laws were passed in many southern states. Many whites were angry to be forced by law to share a school, a library, or a concert hall. This was too much for them to accept, as they were against the liberal presidents, Congress, and the Supreme Court, who wanted to make a better country with freedom, justice, and liberty to all its citizens. Instead, It was a land of continual slavery and servitude, as there were laws still oppressing the Negroes, and there was little hope in their communities. In November 1961, a comic magazine called The Fantastic Four, written by Stan Lee, told of the daring deeds of four citizens who fought the enemies of America. Yet America's worst enemy was itself, as it ignores its own citizens of color and denied them the same rights as whites. Four young college students would be considered the real Fantastic Four, who would change the segregation of lunch and dining counters, restaurants, and cafeterias in America. These young men did not yield and returned daily for a sit-in to challenge a discriminating and moral law and help start a movement all over the nation. They defeated a real enemy of America and became heroes in African-American history. I appreciate that when I want to sit down at a table or a counter to order, I would be served a good hot meal with no harsh look, slander, or threats against me. To never hear, "We don't serve your kind," or "There's no seating for your color," or to be threatened with cruel profanity, or tossed out and arrested for sitting in an American restaurant. Never to see a sign boldly printed, "Negroes, colors, blacks, or African Americans not served." For hundreds of years, my ancestors were denied that privilege. They were treated worse than the farm animals, given food scraps and cold leftovers. Very few people of color stepped over the line of segregation that had denied them the right to be served at any public establishment. To cross the line, you might be arrested, beaten, or even killed. This was the case for all Negro citizens in the United States. It seems as if the cost were too great. These citizens had contributed blood, sweat, tears, and even their lives in every war America had fought, though they were never seen as equals by their fellow Americans. Something had to change. No longer were these young men and women of color going to be humble and submissive as their parents. They were a new generation, and they did not know the firsthand horrors of bondage and slavery. They set out to change a demeaning law that had stood for years, separating and preventing all citizens from dining together. Knowing what had happened to a young child named Emmett Till, who had been brutally tortured and murdered in Mississippi, was fresh in their minds. The younger generation chose to defy the consequences of harm and death and rose to counter the ways of violence against them. They no longer were satisfied with the seats in the back of the bus or the movie theater. They no longer accepted inferior schools, hospital housing, and jobs. They saw a better America with the Democratic Party led by JFK spoke of its campaign's promises to advance civil rights issues and social programs. Their confidence was high, and they had to be in the forefront to push their agenda for equal rights through. The college students began a plan of action as they were tired of the same old non-action against segregation, discrimination, and humiliation that they were forced to endure, and saw a change a-coming. They had to be part of it, and they began to convince other students, support, organize, and join in the struggle for civil and social rights. They were inspired by the June 23, 1957 sit-in at the Royal Ice Cream Parlor in Durham, North Carolina, where seven well-dressed African-American students were arrested for ordering ice cream while sitting at the counter where white-only service was provided. It has set the tone for the youth who would guide the movement and the education and the nonviolence as the struggle became a peaceful one, not centered on hate and violence, but on peace and bonding of equal justice and rights for all. Joseph McNeil, Franklin McLean, David Richmond, and Zell Blair Jr. had talked about what they could do to protest segregation laws in Greensboro that discriminated against Negroes in public places. They chose the local downtown Woolworth Variety Store that had a white-only seating lunch counter. This was humiliating as Negroes were paying customers of the store but deemed unfit to sit at the counter. They feared they would be beaten, arrested, or even killed by a white mob that was sure to assemble to cause them bodily harm. They feared expulsion from the school and disappointment from their professors and parents. They all agreed that the time was now, and they were right in their belief that all men were created equal in the eye of God. So they proudly dressed that money in their tie. They wanted the world to remember them and walk from campus to downtown Greensboro. Their fate would be recorded in history as heroes or the struggle or martyrs in the death of a cause. As they walked into the store, it was more than the chill of the 50-degree February morning that made them shudder in their winter coats. It was the realization that they could not turn back as others had before. They must see this through. After buying toothpaste, notebooks, and a hairbrush, they stuffed the receipts in their pockets to prove they were paying customers. Then they sucked in their breath and headed to a destiny that would affect their lives forever. They could smell the scent of the fresh country ham and cheese biscuits along with the freshly made apple pie. Bacon and tomato sandwiches and eggs sizzling on the grill were being served to others. The four young college students sat down on the stools and began to request that someone take their order. They heard the whirl of the fountain soda machine and watched the banana split being made while hot coffee was being brewed. A king-size Coke was only 10 cents, and it would have been good to drink one as their mouth seemed to be dry with anticipation of what might happen next. The white waiter refused to serve them and asked them to make their orders to go. They sat still as the whites near them became hushed, continuing to eat in silence. It became more like a church service than a five and dime store, according to McLean. Years later, an older black woman came from the back who must have been worried about her job or the safety of the students. She suggested they should follow the rules as her generation had. Defiantly, they disagreed and told her that those days were over. Her generation had changed very little, so they continued to sit against reprimand, meaning no trouble. They just wanted to be served like all others. The store manager, Clarence Harris, confronted the students, suggested they rethink their actions before they got into trouble. Still, the four remained seated. A police officer was called, and he tried to intimidate the four by taking out his billy club and whacking it hard against the palm of his hand. Everyone knew that this meant, but these young men sat so, for they had done nothing to provoke a sure beating to death. Finally, without uttering a word, the officer let them be and left the store. The store manager then closed the store early that day. As the four had sat there in fear, they began to understand the power of nonviolence, as the officer didn't know what to do in that situation and left because he knew the law was unjust for kids just wanting to eat and enjoy a meal. The last person to approach them before leaving the store that day was an elderly white woman who was sitting there as everything unfolded. She walked over to them and sat down next to McLean and looked at them and told them she was disappointed in them. McLean was ready to defend their actions. He remained calm and asked the woman, "Ma'am, why are you disappointed in us for asking to be served like anyone else?" She put her hand on Joe McNeil's shoulder and said, "I am disappointed. It took you so long to do this." There was no stopping this action now, and it spread to other cities. That July, the Negro kitchen staff was the first to be seated and served, and then the Greensboro Four were next. By the fall of 1960, people of color had desegregated most of the eating establishments in America. There was only one picture released to the press that day, but it said it all. It was published as four young Negro students who defied Jim Crow at a Southern lunch counter and won. They were fearless and brave. These Negro students, intelligent, handsome, well-dressed, dignified, with a steadfast position to not to succumb to the fears and intimidation of their, what their forefathers had, now stood tall in the eyes of the Negro communities they represented as worthy to be served in America. Some say we may remember the past in a mythical way, with superhuman heroes as leaders and as religious spirits of how they helped us navigate the perils of life. I say it takes faith in one's God, oneself, and one's brother, that he is not alone and what is morally right, but is the right of mankind himself. All men were born free. It is evil men who are wrong to try to suppress freedom and liberty. In 1993, an 8-foot section of the counter area in four stools where they sat was removed from the Woolworth store and placed in the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C. In 2002, a statue of them was placed in their honor on the campus of A&T State University in Greensboro, North Carolina. The Woolworths have become the International Civil Rights Center and Museum in their honor with the remaining lunch counter. In 2010, they received the Smithsonian Institute's James Smithsonian Bicentennial Medal. They all received many awards and honors for their actions that day. Joseph McNeil, born in 1942, is 81 years, graduated in 1963, retired Major General, United States Air Force. Go out and do something. No one can take your self-pride away. Franklin McLean, born in 1942, died in 2014, graduated in 1964 with degrees in chemistry and biology. We cannot await the arrival of others to do something we know as right. David Richmond, born 1941, died 1990, majored in business administration and accounting. I wish to do all I can to help free my people from hardships and oppression. Exel Alexander Blair, Jr., born 1941, 82 years today, graduated in 1963, degree in social studies. He was labeled the troublemaker, but later became a historian, orator, storyteller, and lecturer of African-American studies. My hero, the Fantastic Four. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Alex, for your message to the community. And as we celebrate African History Month, we'd like to remind you that before this month is out, make sure you learn something new about your people and about the world, and so that you can have a better understanding of how to change it. So what we're going to do right now, we're going to take a station break, and when we come back, we're going to have the discussion on the immigration game with our special guest, John Standback, and Sister Namia, and we have many other callers lined up to give their views and their perspectives on this particular important issue. You're listening to the voice of MPH Radio, and we're going to play My Africa, and we'll return to have this discussion.
You'll find sometimes you know where you are, but not where you want to be. Just take your time, really pace yourself, have a little bit of faith in you. You'll find, you know, and then you don't. You'll find that you feel it, and then you don't. It's only the beginning. Please don't sweat it. It's only the beginning.
We love you,
yeah, we love you,
and we need.
over meaning, my brother. Yeah, just set the pace for the rest to follow. Shine on, shine on. You'll find some time to know where you are, but know where you wanna be. Just take your time, embrace yourself, have a little bit of faith in you.
My Africa, we need Africa. Welcome back to MPH Radio. We're going to begin our discussion today, the immigration game. We're going to bring in our host, Brother John, and our special guest, Brother John Steinbach and Sister Namia, and all our callers who have been lined up to give their perspectives on this particularly important issue. And basically, we're going to be structured and unstructured as we discuss this particular topic. And what I want to do right now is just give you a backdrop that there's an interesting documentary on YouTube titled The Truth About Illegal Immigration Crisis that you should check out. And we're going to just cite some of the points that were made from that particular documentary in terms of giving a backdrop as we discuss this theme today, the immigration game. And there's another video on YouTube called Hear What Marvin Said About Blacks that raises some issues. So let us just give you some backdrop on this, and then we're going to open up this discussion and bring in our guests, and then bring you in. And some of the issues when we think about immigration and this issue that is taking place in the borders, at the borders of U.S., North and South, is that many times there are death crossing. They say it takes 60,000 border employees are employed to deal with this issue as of today. There is a budget for this year operation just to deal with immigration is $16 billion. You're talking about $25 billion for this upcoming year. 1.3 million goes to courts for getting us into the U.S. You have this whole process being under the direction and banner of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And is it really a security institution? It's around 800,000 people who tried to cross the border, got away illegally. You have 32 folks who came across. Many of them have been labeled as so-called criminals. We had over 70,994 families as a group came across the border. We had over 259,000 people that were deported back to where they came from, or at least outside the U.S. in the year 2023. Walmart hired many of these immigrants as contractors. They were recently fined millions of dollars. 35% of those who come here speaks no English. 14% of all immigration makes up the American population. We talk about 15% of the money that they make goes back home to their family. Many people believe this immigration crisis is a issue of competition for jobs and resources. We're in the U.S. What do y'all think about that? And last not least, which is real interesting, is that they have reported that there's this industry struggling business market. They make over $1 billion in smuggling many immigrants into the border. So those are just some of the dynamics that make up this whole issue of immigration. And what we're going to do right now, we're going to open up the discussion as we discuss this whole issue of, as we call it, the immigration game. First, we'd like to bring in our guests. We have with us Brother John Steinbach. He will introduce himself, and we would like for him to open up with his thesis of what he think about this immigration game. And then he'll be followed by Sister Namia. She will open up her presentation, and she address what she think about this immigration game. So, Brother John, what we're going to do right now, we're going to bring you in right now. And we'd like to welcome you to MPH. Welcome, Brother John. Briefly introduce yourself and give us your general opening statement on this immigration game. Brother John, the mic is yours.
Thank you, Brother Lee. I work with Woodbridge Workers Committee. The community coordinator for Mexicans Without Borders back during the immigration crisis in Prince William County. So I've been working with the immigrant community for the last 35 years. And I think that to understand what's going on, we have to look at the history. So, and the history really starts 50,000 years ago when the first migrants crossed the Bering, the land bridge, the Bering, migrated to the Western Hemisphere. And this migration has been going on. Chief Billy Tyack of the Piscataway Indian Nation reminded us that the migrants are Indian people largely. They're Native Americans, and that Native Americans have the right to migrate anywhere in the United States. I think the other thing we need to remember is that these are our sisters and brothers. These are working people, and we have to keep in mind working class solidarity. So the U.S. economy in the 20th century particularly became very dependent upon migrant labor. During World War II, many of the young men were sent to fight in Europe, and the Roosevelt administration came up with the Bracero program. The Bracero program was mostly Mexican farm workers who were brought across the border to work, to do the work, all the work in the fields. And they would be brought for 6 months, then they would be sent back to Mexico, and 20% of their wages was withheld and was given to the Mexican government. And, of course, the Mexican government, the oligarchs kept that money for themselves. And so this went on until the early 1960s when the Bracero program was ended. And what happened after that was that that system largely continued. So what happened was is that, mostly Mexicans, mostly campesinos would cross the border. They would work for 6 months or 8 months in the fields, and then they would return back to their villages during the wintertime, and then they would cross the border again. And there were songs written about this. Woody Guthrie wrote Pastures of Plenty and the Plane Wreck at Los Gatos Canyon. Merle Haggard wrote the Immigrant Song. all dealing about this and all supporting the immigrants as, people that were doing essential work and that they should be respected. All of this started to change under Reagan, but particularly under Bill Clinton, things got very difficult. So what Clinton did is he criminalized immigration, and he was the first, way before Donald Trump, he was the first to militarize the border. And it made it very difficult for migrants to cross over, work in the fields, and then come back across the border. So what they did is when they crossed the border, because it was so dangerous, they crossed the border and then they stayed here. But that wasn't the only thing that Clinton did, and that wasn't the most important thing. The important thing was NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. So I was part of that struggle, and many of the listeners here, I'm sure, were part of that struggle to defeat NAFTA. That was originally Reagan's idea. And then George Bush, the senior, pushed that idea. And we fought tooth and nail, and we fought it back under Reagan. We fought back under Bush successfully. But Clinton, what made that the cornerstone of his presidency, passed NAFTA. It was not enough that he ended welfare as we know it. It's not enough that he and Biden are responsible for mass African-American and poor people's incarceration. He insisted that NAFTA be signed, and that one of the cornerstones of the NAFTA agreement was that Mexico had to agree to abolish the Ejido movement. And the Ejido movement was established by Emiliano Zapata during the Mexican Revolution. Zapata was indigenous, and he said indigenous communities have the right to collectively organize. And so thousands and tens of thousands of Native American communities throughout Mexico organized collectively their own farms. What Clinton did is demanded Mexico had to abolish that system, and at the same time, he imposed the export of factory-farmed corn particularly, but factory-farmed U.S. factory-farmed products across the border without any taxes. And what that did is it drove millions and millions of indigenous campesinos off the land. And the plan had been that they were going to, that the corporations were going to move their work to the border, to the maquiladoras, and then to southern Mexico as well under the plan Panama. And but a lot of that didn't materialize. The jobs left, but they were sent to China and Vietnam and other places instead of Mexico. So what happened is you had millions of campesinos that could no longer farm, and they had no work to do. They had no way to make a living. So by the tens of thousands, they moved to the U.S., and this was about the same time that Clinton basically dismantled all the environmental regulations and all the corporate regulations like Glass-Steagall, and I could go on. And so the corporate headquarters all moved. A lot of them moved to Northern Virginia, where I live. And so there was a massive, massive demand for labor, and there were all of these displaced campesinos. So that was kind of the beginning of the refugee crisis. And then we fast forward to Obama. And then what Obama did is he further criminalized illegal immigration. And what he did is he used secure communities and several other programs to turn local police into immigration agents. And we were at ground zero here. And so Obama was responsible for more deportations of, quote, illegal immigrants than all previous presidents combined. And then Trump comes in. Of course, he built his wall. And then we have Biden today. So I just want to say one other thing to bring us up to the present, and that is that a lot of the immigrants that we're seeing today that are crossing the border, they're not from Mexico. They're actually from Honduras, where we orchestrated a coup. And then in the aftermath of that coup, Honduras became the most violent nation on earth, from El Salvador, where we funded the death squads, and then in the vacuum, groups like MS-13 basically run the show. A lot of the migrants that are coming are from Venezuela, from Cuba, from Africa, from India, and a lot of that immigration from around the world that's now coming through the southern border is because of U.S. foreign policy, which the listenership knows only too well, is totally rapacious. That the U.S. policy has been and continues to be basically to crush any kind of independence anywhere in the world, especially Africa, and then basically prop up vassals and then basically take all of the slave labor and take all of the resources and so on. And that, so that's the root of this policy. So it brings us up to where we are today. So the last thing I want to say is we have to remember that these are our sisters and brothers, and they are workers too, and that, a lot of revolutionary people, including my friend Bob Brown, I've talked over and over and over again that we need to unite in struggle, and we need to understand that solidarity is a mutual thing, and that when we work together in solidarity, that's how we beat the system. So let's not fall into the trap of marginalizing our sisters and brothers. So I wanted to bring that history to the table.
I thank you, Brother John. And I thank we had Sister Nami. We're trying to find her. I just stuck out of way, made a loss on my board. So hopefully if she called back in, we'll pick her up. But in the meantime, what we're going to do is we're going to open up to our callers and get their perspective on this question as we talk about the immigration game. We're going to call them. 6057, call us 6057. What is your thought on this issue of the immigration game? Call us 6057.
Okay. Thanks for having me on the program. Thank you, John, for your presentation. Let's say I thought it gave a very, excellent analysis of immigration to the U.S. And it was very informative. And also, you get into some of the roots of the immigration problem as it exists in the U.S. presently. And I want to add that historically, immigration to the U.S. has been followed a very racist policy, consistent with the racism that exists inside the U.S. And there seems to be a preference for immigrants coming out of Europe. They seem to have no problems getting here. Most of the controversy around immigration tends to, comes to down to indigenous and African and Asian laborers. This is where the controversy lies. However, there's very often very little background given to the station that exists in Asia, Africa, Central and South America and the Caribbean, which causes people to seek a better life in the metropolitan capitalist countries like Western Europe and the U.S. and Canada. There's the exploitation of labor caused by capitalism worldwide that is fueling this problem. The U.S. is spending, billions of dollars to protect its border from an immigrant problem that is caused by U.S. corporations.
Thank you, caller 6057. We'd like to now make a transition to caller 6029. 6029. Give us your take on this immigration game, caller 6029. The mic is yours.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. It is a game. And when Brother John talked about the historical elements pertaining to this question of immigration, I think it's important that we take heed in terms of the importance of the historical wrongs committed against indigenous people in the Western Hemisphere. Now, also, I think one of the things we can't discount is this whole notion around, the monetary value in terms of immigration. One of the things is that, we talk about, the immigrants being a drain on the U.S. economy, but the reality is that immigration actually boosts the U.S. economy. Now, according to recent studies, immigrants, on average, commit between $6 to $12 billion to the U.S. economy yearly. And much of that is done not because of, there's some kind of legal means in terms of doing so, but exists in part because the federal government itself wants illegal immigration inside the United States government. For instance, when we talk about in terms of importance of Social Security cards, a lot of these immigrants don't have Social Security cards. They have access to individual tax identification numbers, which enables them to pay taxes on the wages that they receive. And so therefore, when you think about the fact that immigrants pay these taxes, without receiving any benefits, then we truly understand the impact the immigrants have on the overall function of the U.S. economy. So in that regard, so when we talk about the monetary advantages of immigration, the advantages are very, very clear. And so we should not deceive ourselves into believing that, in fact, that immigrants are a drain on the U.S. economy. And more importantly, I think one of the things politically I think we have to clearly understand is that the question around immigration is really merely a distraction. This is done particularly because, as long as we're focused on, quote, the bad immigrants, so-called illegal immigrants, then we don't focus on those things that we need to take focus on in terms of the economic disparities that exist in society. We don't take focus in terms of deteriorating infrastructure in society. We don't take attention, we don't call attention to the devastating wage declines that are taking place in the society. So those things that we should be focused on, we tend to focus on immigrants because they're easy targets. So my position is that, listen, one of the things we have to understand, aside from the question in terms of immigrants being part of the working class, we have to formally understand the question in terms of humanity. If, in fact, the U.S. policy didn't facilitate a lot of these problems with respect to national economies around the world, people would have no need to come to the United States in the first place. So it seems to me that if we're really concerned about terms of immigration, then one of the things we have to insist is that the U.S. CIA, agency of independent AID, and all these organizations that are geared toward undermining the economies of these nations around the world, cease their activities in terms of undermining economies, which means that people have no need in terms of coming to the United States. They're able to get those things they need in their countries, assuming that these countries are in a position to actually determine their own economic fate. So as long as the United States control the economic destination of these countries, then clearly we understand that these people have a moral imperative of coming to the U.S. because they think that the U.S. offers them the best opportunity in terms of survival. So clearly our work is to see the U.S. government for what it is and the ravages of U.S. government in terms of its impact on the immigration. And I close with that.
Thank you, Carla. We've got Sister Namia back on, our other guest. We're going to bring her in right now. Sister Namia, give us your take on this issue of the immigration game. The mic is yours. Sister Namia.
Okay. Shalom, everybody. Greetings. I'm sympathetic with the immigrants that come here. You know, it's very sad that, as the brother said there, their countries are so economically impoverished that people would risk life and limb to cross the border and, you know, just so many hazardous conditions that they would have to endure on the way over here. But the thing about it, I'm not particularly in alliance with them coming at this particular point, and I'm going to tell you why. There's a lot of homeless people all over the United States. There's a lot of homeless people that have been ignored for so many years. If you look at the West Coast, you got people that have been sleeping in Walmart parking lots and trailers and cars for years, black and white and otherwise. Remember that black people are only 13% of the population, so a lot of these homeless people are white, you know. And the thing about it is I was recently in New York a couple of months ago, and I sat there and I witnessed at the a loft, which is a very expensive hotel that most of us on this line probably can't afford, taking these hotels in New York, and this is a brand new one, and put them in there and giving them iPads and money and all this other kind of stuff. But when you come out, because I was in Queens, I witnessed this on Jamaica Avenue. When you come out on Jamaica and Sufkin, you got American people that are sitting on the sidewalk, and they're getting no help at all. And this is the problem I have with the whole immigration question. I respect both of those callers that talked about how we have created chaos and havoc, and I agree with that because we have. I'd have to be very ignorant not to understand that. But at the same time, as an American and as a person who's witnessed so much homelessness for so many years and the government not trying to help, even right here in Richmond, you got over 2,000 homeless people on the street, and they tell a lie in the newspaper, it's 400 and something. No, it's 2,000 people, men, women, children, and veterans. And my concern is taking care of people that are here in this country before we continue to allow other people to come from other places for whatever reason and take care of them. I can't see it. I'm sorry. I really, really, really can't see it. And it disturbs me a lot. And there is crime going on in New York and Chicago and other places. And I'm not saying that all these people are criminals, but you got the good, bad, and the ugly coming across the border. Let's face it. Okay, just like you have the good, bad, and the ugly that are already here. And I'm just saying, to me, it's adding more fuel to the fire. We as individuals can work together, as the brother said, in terms of trying to get more better working conditions, higher minimum wage, and all of that kind of stuff. But all I'm saying is, let's focus on what the heck is going on in this country with the people that are already here. I'm in sympathy with them. I go to Mexico. Okay, I travel. I know about poverty. But all I'm saying is, what about the people that have been here all along? What about the homeless people in America from coast to coast that are here all along that they're ignoring while they're trying to take care of these new people that came across the border? I'm just being real. It may not be popular, and I can't apologize for it because that's the way I really feel. That's all I got to say.
Okay, thank you, Sister. Hold on. You have said so many valid things going on in the discussion, and we'll continue to have the discussion. So we'll be coming back to you from time to time. We're going to take our next call on 4298. caller 4298. Welcome to MPH Radio. What is your take on this immigration game? 4298, the mic is yours.
Yes, my name is Robert Moses. I consider myself to be a professional revolutionary, and so, you know, I come at this question from the international perspective of the working class and its primary objective of overthrowing capitalism and imperialism and abolishing all oppression, racism, sexism, and chauvinism of all sorts. And so, you know, this issue is, from that perspective, is one of the working class interests, and the working class has no borders. As Che Guevara taught us, the struggle of the working class has no borders, because the capitalists have, and the international finance capitalists have no borders. Imperialist class have no borders. They're oppression. And we have to understand that the political economy of the world, there's one world, the political economy, and we can see three divisions: the superpowers, the developed countries, and the third world, Asia, Africa, Latin America, and people of color. And the U.S., you can see the exploitation taking place as the money is being sucked up. It's not trickling down. And the wages, if you look at the wages in these various countries, you can see the political economy. The poor are being exploited and working for nothing practically, and the money is being sucked up. And then we have the superpowers who are enjoying a life of luxury. We have the bought off labor aristocracy who sold out the working class interests. And it's time that the working class recognize its interests and working recognize it itself as interest as a class, and take up the political struggle and change this system, change this world. A new world is possible. And I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlo. As we continue to have this discussion, for those who listen to this program, we encourage you to call in at 818-337-0016. We'd like to hear your perspective. This is MPH Radio, and we're going to bring in our Sister Murray. Sister Murray, give us your take on this immigration game. The mic is yours, Sister Murray.
Yeah. First of all, I just want to thank you, Mr. Lee, for having me on the show today. And it's a very interesting show, but I don't remember the name of the lady who spoke, but I'm pretty much with her. And my brother Alec will tell you, I have so much compassion for people, but she just put it right on the line what it is in regards to having. I think we should have, first of all, a number of people. There should be a number. There should be a limit to how many of them come and cross the border to live in this country. Because otherwise, it will drain, and it is draining social services, draining the hospitals, the school system, housing, and taking a lot from the medical system. We have so many people, as she stated, that's on the street. We get to see it, me and my husband, pretty much two or three times a week when we drive to Charlottesville, Virginia. And we see people begging for money, people sleeping on the street. We see the homeless when we go into Washington, D.C. It's all around us. And we need to do something about it. We need to take care of home first. But I understand that people won't have a better life being an African-American. I can definitely say that. I lived back in that day of couldn't go into different stores. If I went into a store to had a hat on, you had to put a scarf on your head in order to wear that hat. So I do understand where she is coming from. And that's my take on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Sister Mary. We'll come back to you as we continue to have the discussion. Let's go hear our brother Alex. Brother Alex, you have heard many things on this immigration game. Your response to what you have heard so far in your position, Brother Alex.
Well, first of all, Mr. Lee, I would like to say, you know, I am thankful that a bust of Dr. King and Hugo Chavez, you know, is in Oval Office right now, because neither one of those gentlemen would have been in there many years ago because of what they were fighting for, what they believed in, and who they tried to help. So when we go back, and I would like to go back a little bit further, I would say coming out of the Civil War and needing labor and manpower in America, and as cheaply as possible, was the first time that Mexicans actually crossed the border and came over and did work for almost wages that no one would accept today. And then officially in 1917, Woodrow Wilson brought many over to help in World War I. And he also worked worse than Roosevelt ever dreamed possible. And these workers, many of them died, Chinese on the railroads in different places, the other immigrants who came into the country and died and worked for America or whatever and got the worst of wages going inside of mines and everything else. But in those fields that they worked at from 1917, that they were started being deported in 1929 because the country no longer needed them because we were facing the Great Depression. So they were deported out of here. When we look at how America has treated the poor from day one, this has never been a country that thought about the poor at all. It only saw the rich as being privileged and worthy to vote and worthy to own property, worthy to go to school to learn. Even Woodrow Wilson in the 1970, the literary test for the immigrants. And, you know, when a person comes here to say legally, because they're you know, we got an immigration question here, but, you know, I would also like to reflect that we got two types of immigration. We got the ones that come here legally, and we have the ones that come here illegally. And then, we got the third type, the gotaways, the ones we have no idea what happened, how they got across, or whatever. So in this mixture of individuals, whether they legal, illegal, gotaways, or whatever, yeah, they're going to be bad individuals. As the fellow panelists said, they're bad individuals all over the world. So are they any worse than anyone else? Well, what makes a man worse, as Dr. King said, you know, when you oppress him and he has nothing, will he steal to eat? You know, will he take the life of another, you know, just to survive? These are just some things that, you know, come up serious in the migrant community, you know, of as they exchange, because, you know, they're coming here from brutal dictatorships, from brutal governments, and a lot of them don't see nothing better. But yet and still, once they do get here, a huge proportion of them, yes, they do send that money, you know, back home to try and make things better in their home life and in their communities. And maybe the money is mishandled on the way even going back. It costs many of them thousands of dollars to even get here, where they pay different people to try and get them to America. And then this money, once they get here, they got to work it off. And if they can't, some of them are beaten and killed, and whatever, if they can't pay the money back that they were able to get into this country, and this the illegal ones. I believe that anyone that wants to apply here legally should have that opportunity to become a citizen. If they're, like my sister said, if there's a certain number that the country takes in every year, because we have taken in people from everywhere on this globe. We've taken in Afghanistan. We've taken in Jews. We've taken in anyone that's been persecuted. So we're willing to take all these people in and provide them with health care and provide them with education and provide them with financial resources and provide them with land, then we really have to look over our whole policy of what we do for our own citizens as was raised. Because we're looking beyond our own. I have children in my home. I'm a father. But how much compassion would I have to take in another child? You know, that's what we're basically doing, is taking in another child. So we're taking in that child with all his problems and everything else. But we know our children at home also have problems. How many children can we support? Don't take in a child if you can't support them. Don't have a child if you can't support them. You know, there's fundamental moral issues here that we have to discuss today. And, you know, we're doing a great job of it. But it's just so many eras of this immigration, you know, thing that we're talking about today. Because remember, we're talking about ourselves as a country and what we can continue to support. You know, our budget is made every year, and it's just like your budget at home. We have to consciously think what we can do. We can't take care of everybody in the world. The United States can't do it. Not at all. We might want to do it, but we can't. So we have to start drawing lines somewhere at what we can do. And these legislators have to get together. There's been many bills up there in Congress that could have taken care of this years ago or helped it out. I wouldn't say taking care of it because I don't believe you'll ever solve immigration. But that would have made it. Countries wouldn't be fleeing here if we hadn't put all those sanctions and embargoes against countries. If we just didn't want to be the top dog and just basically monetarily and financially, you know, basically rape these South American countries and other countries doing our colonialism ideas of making sure that America was the wealthiest country on this continent. And as we continue that thought in Congress that everybody's, you know, got to come to America for this reason or that reason, yeah, they're going to come across the border for that reason. So we're just expending too much out here as a country. And countries are looking at America as in hope that they can have a better life, they can do better here. But America has to realize there has to be limits. And that's all I got to say.
Thank you, Brother Alex. We now go back to Brother John. Brother John, based on some of the comments you have heard, would you like to respond to some of these comments from your perspectives as it relates to this immigration game? Brother John.
Yeah, thank you, Brother Lee. So this has been a really great discussion, an important discussion. I would come up with several points, and that is that when we look at the situation today and we talk about, you know, there are limits and that, you know, we need to enforce the laws and so on, that what got us here was, you know, particularly back in the 1990s, was criminalizing immigration across the border, like building the walls, beefing up ICE. ICE was created during the Clinton administration in order to basically quote, control the borders, unquote. But the problem is that there are no limits to U.S. imperialism. U.S. imperialism basically exists in order to create chaos, to prop up all of these various dictators that we're talking about, creating impossible situations around the world. I would just like to say, Brother Lee, that Woodbridge Workers Committee, our fundamental principles align with the Zapatistas in Mexico, the indigenous people that have created their own individual collective efforts, particularly in the mountains of Chiapas. And the Zapatista position is that people should fight against imperialism in their own country. So they discourage, you know, immigration to the U.S. So that's fundamentally our position. But we look at, you know, we have to look at this from a systemic point of view. You know, what is forcing this, and what are, you know, if some of the speakers, you know, would like to control this situation, I want you to think about what would happen. So let's go back in history to the 1950s in the Eisenhower administration. And what happened when the Eisenhower administration basically locked down almost the entire Rio Grande Valley, especially in Texas, and implemented these tremendous dragnet deportation sweeps, where they would send buses into communities of immigrants and would take people, pick them up off the street, and then bus them across the border to Mexico. And thousands and tens of thousands of American citizens ended up, you know, across the border. And the, of course, point was that the border is artificially made. It is a national construct, and the people, you know, of the Rio Grande Valley that were caught up in this massive, massive sweep were people that lived on both sides of the border, but they had family on both sides of the border. And, you know, from their point of view and from the indigenous point of view, you know, the border was a line in the sand. And so, but today, fast forward, we have, you know, a broken, I agree with this on all the speakers, we have a broken immigration system. So what's happening, as I said, is that probably the majority of the people that are coming to the southern border are not from Mexico, or not even from Mexico or Central America anymore. They're from South America. They're from West Asia. They're from Africa. They're from all over the world, and they're coming. They're hiring these coyotes. It was mentioned that, you know, this human trafficking situation of immigrants is a $1 billion business. I think that is exaggeration downward. I think it's vastly more than that. So these are the systemic issues that we're dealing with. And if we, you know, if there is an effort which appears to be happening, the Democrats are seeming, as they always are, ending up being worse than the Republicans. And we all know this. And what are we talking about? We're talking about massive sweeps. We're talking about, you know, concentration camps. And Trump talked about it, and it appears that this is what's happening right now. There are a number of camps, for example, in New York City, where migrants are being housed, and those could have very easily be turned into concentration camps where they're being held. And it's going to break up families. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be a massive, massive human rights violation. And are we sure that we want to go down this road? And then the last thing I'd like to say is there was some discussion about legal immigration and illegal immigration. And the point is that the corporations, they really don't care, because it's all about, you know, fulfilling their needs. So they're very happy with, you know, people that are crossing the border who will do construction work and do that kind of work, labor, working in nursing homes and so on. They're very happy with that, but they're just as happy or even more happy with the visas that are given to the high-tech workers from, you know, Western Asia and from Africa and from Asia, East Asia, and basically all over the world. So the countries of the world are paying for their education and paying for them to go to college and paying for their training. And then after India, Pakistan, Nigeria, and so on have paid for all of this, you know, we are very, very happy to take those immigrants, because it's a brain drain. It's a freebie. So we have to understand all of this and understand that if you don't have a high-tech degree, or if you don't have $1 million, you're basically not going to get in the U.S. legally. It's just not going to happen because that's not the way the immigration system is set up. So when we talk about illegal immigrants, that for the vast majority, there is no legal entry to the U.S. So I agree, the system is totally broken, and I really appreciate it, Lee, that you had this this discussion, because I think it's been very clarifying.
Thank you, John. Hold on. Let's bring in another new caller. Caller, we're discussing the immigration game. We'd like to have your thoughts on this issue of this immigration. Caller 7236. Welcome to MPH Radio. 7236, the mic is yours.
Well, I just want to thank you all for having this wonderful discussion and including the indigenous perspective on immigration in the United States. And right now, revolutionaries of the United States that are looking for real change are facing a difficult situation with immigration. We have the lumping proletariat from Venezuela and Colombia trying to come to the United States while unknown imperialist nations are trying to undermine the election of the Colombian people in 2023. And you also have people, because of the undermining of the Venezuelan government by outside forces, running from their country and blaming the problems on the state rather than looking at how imperialism impacts the governments of South America. And so it is a terrible time in that, as the last speaker said, we see people from the Cameroon running from Paul, who has been in office for 35 years. And we see a great deal of atrocity. But I'd just like to say thank you for the show, and I want to continue listening.
Thank you, Carla. Thank you for your participation and your support of MPH Radio. We're going to make the transition to Carla 6057. 6057, we'd like to bring you back in. And I would like for you to speak to this narrative of, I'm not quite sure if those who use the word immigrants, who give them the right to say someone is the immigrant when the so-called original Europeans from Europe who came to this country and took over these lands, they were as much of an immigrant as folks that they call in Judea are immigrant. Do they have any kind of moral authority to make rules and set rules on who go where and how people can travel? No response to that contradiction. Call the 6057.
Yeah. Only the indigenous people have that right. Everybody else is an immigrant. You know, regardless of the circumstances under which they got to the Western Hemisphere. What I wanted to point out is that the world is dominated by imperialism. And imperialism exploits labor at all costs. And it's imperialism that is making things so miserable for the countries of Asia, Africa, Central and South America, that is fueling the migration to the imperialist countries, and the imperialists take advantage of this, as John pointed out, to exploit the labor of the world. And the solution to it is the working class has to get better organized than it has been. A systemic oppression like this can only be defeated by permanent organization. And so it takes, moving against the system, but it takes organization, and that's seriously lacking among the masses of African people worldwide. We have to get better organized in order to defeat imperialism.
Thank you, caller 6057. We now will go to caller 6029. Caller 6029. I want to highlight two contradictions that comes out of this particular struggle, the immigration game. That is the competition between resources within a given community. And the second one is the politicians can use this, or they are using this also as a tool, one, to help make money from this immigration game. But more importantly, they have set up these communities to have internal fighting among each other that may take place in the near future. Your response to those contradictions, Carter, 6029.
Yeah, well, let me approach your question from a slightly different perspective. One of the things, as I sit and I listen to people's critique in terms of immigration, they talk about essentially that immigrants are a problem economically. I find that fascinating, speaking as though somehow immigrants, in fact, are in control, of the economic system that exists in America. Here's the thing. Back in the 70s and the 80s, when the U.S. government decided to remove all its factories and production from the U.S. around the world, particularly to China, we have to understand that in doing so, it created a tremendous amount of unemployment here in the United States. But yet, no one wants to talk about the unemployment that's systematically produced as a result of U.S. economic policy. We must rather blame immigrants in terms of situations like unemployment or poor wages and so forth, as somehow immigrants are responsible for the economic plight of people in America. I'm confused. I don't understand that. When corporations take 53 cents of every dollar produced in society, simply because they can, when they do that, it has a direct impact in terms of one's ability to find work, to create jobs, the level in which those wages can be sustained. So we talk about the debilitating impact in terms of corporate greed on the labor sector in the society. It is not the immigrants who are responsible for that. It is the American corporation and capitalism itself that's indictable. So it seems to me I don't understand why people are having a difficult time understanding that blaming immigrants is not going to resolve the problem that people face in America. And you're absolutely correct. One of the things, earlier I alluded to the fact that when we talk about immigration's participation in terms of the economic arena, let's be clear on it. Corporations benefit from that agreement. So when I talk about the individual tax and identification numbers, those documents are designed to take the place of Social Security numbers. So immigrants don't need Social Security numbers. They can simply use tax identification numbers in terms of paying their taxes. Now, why is it important that these tax identification numbers exist? Well, it makes it possible for immigrants to pay taxes. Who benefits from the taxes? Not only does U.S. government benefit from the taxes, but also the wealthy benefit from the taxes in terms of having access to those funds from the government for purposes of investments. Immigrants have absolutely nothing to do in terms of that process. That process was created simply because it's in the interest of corporations to do so. So on one level, with the government is browbeating or putting down immigrants, on another level, corporations, the government implicitly is sitting around justifying and creating and supporting immigration on another level. Immigrants are not responsible for that. That is the U.S. government. All right, and let me just say this in conclusion, brother. You know, let us be very, very clear. You know, when we start when we allow the government to pit us against immigrants, essentially what the government is saying is that, listen, in American society, when we talk about economic exploitation, you know, we determine who's going to be economically exploited. When people in society take a position that we are against immigration, they'll say to the U.S. government, listen, given the U.S. exploitation of labor in society, we want you to export us first. Forget about the immigrants, export us first. There's something fundamentally wrong with that premise. And the problem is that because we don't see the exploitation as inherently wrong, we, on a subconscious level, we're willing to justify exploitation on any level, including our own exploitation. And so if we're truly committed in terms of addressing the problems that are from the society, we cannot do so by pointing out, you know, the problem being immigrants. Immigrants are not the problem. It's a system in place that is the problem. Why are we not attacking that system in place that creates these problems in the first place? Why are we not? Why is it so easy to attack immigrants? You know, we can talk immigrants all day long, but immigrants don't control the economic policies. They don't control fiscal or monetary policy of the United States government. They don't. Vested interests control those policies. Those vested interests have no desire in terms of equality, whether we're talking about people indigenous to America, well, let me change that, well, people living in America or people coming into America. Those people vested interest has nothing to do in terms of the interest of the masses or of humanity generally. So let's be very, very clear. Immigrants are not the problem. And as far as the tactics employed by the U.S. government in terms of division, we got to be clever enough to understand that we're being pitted against one another. It seems to me as African people in this society, if anybody should understand that dynamic, it should be African people. We should understand it. Not only are we talking about historically, we look at class stratification in society in which they pitted wealthier African people against poorer African people. If we don't fundamentally understand that dynamic, then I think we're in trouble. So we got to clearly understand that their attempt to pit us against the immigrant community cannot work. We have to understand that. Not because we oppose or support immigration, because we understand just in terms of the advance of humanity, we have a moral obligation, if not a political obligation, to support those forces struggling against injustice. And the system that reinforces injustice is not the immigration system. It is a system of politics, economic, political control practiced by a few people in the society. So clearly, let's get it straight. Let's understand immigrants are not the issue. The issue is a system of exploitation, and I close with that.
So, Carl, I hear you saying that the system of capitalism, imperialism, is a system that creates all of this, and it's the essence of the fundamental contradiction of why we have all these problems we have. So not until those systems are eradicated, then you will have these contradictions and behaviors of the people. Thank you, Carl. At this point in time, this is MPage Radio. It's a community project of the organization of Mr. Page of History. What we're going to do is take a station break, and Sister Mary can lead us through our station break with music with a message by she will give a poem for this month as it relates to African History Month. Then we'll have our break, and when we come back, we will continue this discussion on the immigration game. Sister Mary, the mic is yours.
Sister Lee, I really appreciate it. We're going to talk about Rosa Parks. Rosa, next time you go to board a bus, no one will question, make demands, no arrests, no fuss. For refusing to be intimidated, not giving up your seat. For a person of different race, aggressive in their conceit. But Rosa sparked a protest, and the atmosphere grew tense with a boycott of the buses, and white folks took offense. Many protesters arrested as pushing came to shove, but Dr. King declared, "All those scared we must meet hate with love. Supreme Court held a session, the first across the nation, which upheld Rosa's fight against racial segregation. Announced erasalist enforcement to be completed, not legit. Reward for Rosa's refusal to be silenced or to quit. So remember, Rosa, when you board your bus and you wonder where to sit, Rosa had not stood up. She refused to give up her seat to someone just because they were entitled by their color, but she did. Knowing that she might not live to see another Christmas, knowing she could be dragged out and killed, knowing she could be lynched in front of her loved ones, yet she did it. Rosa Parks was willing to die for what is right, for others' right, for civil rights. Has anyone ever been that brave? I seriously doubt it. We thank you, Miss Rosa Parks. And I give you the mic back, Mr. Lee. Thank you.
Your head. mother's woman friend, and share with black folks not of kin. People must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation
would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss than to bring about a little trust. But we shall overcome, I believe, someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say.
And how long have you had your white teacher?
Who told you you love your black preacher? Can you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? I say now people must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation
would make a better society. And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? If you had a choice.
We'd like to welcome you back to MPH Radio. We're discussing immigration game, the immigration game. We will be closing out the discussion. What we'd like to do first, make a few announcements. Then we'd like to have each one of our participants and guests to make their final, to give their final thoughts on the subject matter today. One of the things we'd like to remind all our listeners and supporters that every weekend on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, if you live in the Richmond metropolitan area of the state of Virginia, you can check out MPH Radio on TV program by going to Comcast Cablevision, channel 95 at 1 a.m., or you can view our program on Verizon Cable Company on channel 36. Check that program. It comes on a weekly basis every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night at 1 a.m. Also, we'd like to remind you that if you'd like to become a supporter, a friend of MPH Radio, please email us at mphradio@yahoo.com, and you can send your flowers to Zelle, and that is Missing Pages of History 1@yahoo.com. And like always, we will try to give you our best, do our best, because you deserve the best. So come and support us and help us. So at this particular time, we'd like to go back to this subject, the immigration game, and I would like each one of y'all to take maybe a minute or so and just make a response to this narrative for the immigration game as you make your final thoughts for tonight. And one of the things we want to keep in mind is that we should never let people play the game of dehumanizing other human beings when we get to the point where we don't even see the humanity in a human being. I think that's one of the things that the game is being played as you look at the issue of immigration in the U.S. and throughout the world. And we also must be conscious of different forms of how immigration takes place, whether through moving people through the concept of, say, immigration, or enslaving them, or gentrification. All these are the same games with different names. So we must be real conscious of the language and how they use things for saying the same thing. So in closing out, what we will do is we'll go to our callers, I'm going to ask each one of y'all to take maybe 1 minute to make your closing statement on this issue of the immigration game. We'll start off with caller 9289. Your thought, caller 9289. Okay, I guess caller 9289 has nothing to say. Let's go to caller 7236. 7236. 1 minute, caller. You find a statement on the immigration game. 7236.
Yes, I want to say it was a fabulous show. And it's true that the immigrants aren't the problem, though for the poor and working class are pitted against the immigrants. But the reality is imperialism is forcing many immigrants to leave their nation. And this month is Black History Month, and I always think of the Langston Hughes, the 1929 magazine, where an anonymous person published the poem, The Willie Lynch, called Willie Lynch, and it's about divide and conquer, and it references the famous Billie Jay, Billie Holiday song about strange fruit, which was banned at the time. But again, I just want to thank you all and all your wonderful guests for a phenomenal show. Thank you, and I look forward to the next show. Thank you so much.
We'd like to thank you, Carla, for your participation as well. Next 1 minute statement, closing statement, we can go to caller 4298. 4298, your closing statement on the immigration game.
Yes, I think the immigration problem is won't be solved until the question of who controls the government is solved, because it's a question of how the government treats its citizenry and the immigrants that are in his country. And so it's a fundamental question of a new democratic society, a revolutionary society, a society that's coming from a historical point of slavery and wage slavery, but moving into a political economy of revolutionary activism and struggle against all injustices and state-sponsored health system and state-sponsored school system from cradle to the grave. So I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you, caller. Next, we'll go to Sister Mary. Your final thoughts, Sister Mary.
Yes, good afternoon again to you. And thank you, Mr. Lee, for this platform today. And I want to thank my brother, Alec, and thank all the guests. Everyone has done such a wonderful job. And to me, at the end of this, it just means that we need a policy. And someone's got to do something about it. And soon. And I give it back to you.
All right. Thank you, Sister Mary. We're going to call the 6029. Your final thoughts, 6029.
Yeah, well, immigration is not going to stop. As long as imperialism exists, immigration will persist. And the question is, at what point are we willing to take a stand and put an end to systemic imperialism? To the extent that we don't put a stop to systemic imperialism, we imperil our own existence. And I close with that.
Call us 6029 for your participation on today's program. And next we're going to call us 6057. 6057.
Yes. My concluding thought is our oppression is systemic, and we'll only defeat imperialism by increasing the level of organization and political education of the workers. And all workers must belong to a political organization that's working to end the exploitation and oppression of the masses of the people. And that can only come about through permanent organization and political education.
Thank you, caller 6057. Brother Alex, give us your final thoughts.
Well, again, Mr. Lee, I can only say it could only be you to find subjects like that that can touch everyone and can bring us to a real conscious of what's going on in America. Because, yes, many folks say this is the nation of immigrants. That's how we started. That's how we got here. But those immigrants were unwelcome European immigrants by the American Indian. So it puzzles me right now with the American Indian is actually thinking about how we are up here discussing all of us that shouldn't even be here. And so we have to think that we can live in peace and harmony in some kind of way and not be pitted against each other, because the ones at the top that control everything and have all the money are causing us this great harm in this nation of people. You know, we are great together. We can do a lot of things together. We can solve a lot of problems together. But we have to work together. We have to come together. And we have to realize that our enemy, again, like Akeem said, not the immigrants. It's always been the wealthy in the government, because they've always turned their back on us and supported their own issues to make money and profit for themselves. Does the government does not like being called the richest nation in the world? Do the richest billionaires that live here not like being called the billionaires? There's a reason for all of that. And that reason is not to put money in me or your pocket. It's to take it away. And then to bring in as cheap a labor as it can, and if not, seek it from somewhere else in the world. So there's a lot that we need to continue to talk about. And we got to remember when we go to that ballot box, you know, who to elect and put in these areas, you know, that we, you know, want to make sense out of what's happening with our dollar and where it's being spent and who's it being spent on. Why is it being spent? We have to be more conscious of our environment and our world. What makes us a people different than any other in this world? It's because we take on challenges and do the right thing. And so will America do the right thing? She hasn't done the right thing since she was in first started. So we have to continue to make a imperfect union somewhere near livable and somewhere livable for us. There's immigration that we cannot stop and just begin a more peaceful and justifiable world, because otherwise we all perish regardless of what. And I'll leave it with that.
Thank you, Brother Alex, for your participation in today's program. And we'll go to one of our special guests, Brother John Steinbeck. You got about 2 minutes to make your final thoughts on the subject tonight, the immigration game. Brother John, the mic is yours.
Thank you, Brother Lee. Thank you for doing this program, and thank you for the Hidden History program. I mean, you just do excellent, excellent work. So I would say this, that don't let them use immigrants as a scapegoat to take our mind off what the real issues are. So while I've been listening to the program, I've been thinking. So I read last week that the average family of four in the United States spends over $30,000 a year on health care. We're talking about record levels for rent and home ownership. We're talking about interest rates being jacked up, which is basically being used to screw the worker and poor folks. We're looking at record levels of child poverty, and this is after during COVID when we had the child tax credit. Child poverty was cut in half, You know, it can be done. All of this can be done. We're talking about the young people that are saddled with $100,000 in student loan debts. And basically, they can't get married. They can't build a house. There are just over and over and over again, we're talking about climate change. We're talking about the threat of nuclear war. We're talking about turning Ukraine into a slaughterhouse. We're talking about genocide in front of our eyes in Gaza, on and on and on. And what do the powers that be do? Oh, look over there. It's those immigrants. It's those criminals. We've got to do something. That's what the issue is. Don't be fooled, folks. Don't be fooled. We have to work together. We have to understand it's capitalism and imperialism that is our foe. We have to work together. And as the SNCC Freedom Singers told us, keep your eyes on the prize. And thanks again, Lee.
And we'd like to thank you, John, for being a special guest on this program, The Immigration Game. We'd like to thank all of our participants, our supporters, and, of course, our listening audience for joining us on a biweekly basis. Our next program will be on February the 2nd at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And as we think about this immigration game, we also must think about that let's not continue to follow down the path of this concept that we call the illusion of inclusion. You don't control no communities because you don't own no communities. You also, this illusion of being a citizen of a country where you don't own and control no capital, meaning in essence, you are no more than a commodity by the rich and the most powerful. So as we think about this game, this immigration game, let's not again be continued to be deceived. So until next time on the 2nd of February, we will continue to travel down the road of filling in our missing pages of history. And we thank you for filling in this page today. As we say, as we check out today, MPH is here for all of us. We'll see you on the 2nd. And as a reminder, we are supporting everyone throughout this country to buy and purchase this book, The Stolen Wealth of Slavery, A Case for Reparation by David Maturo. We are in the process of trying to bring him into our community and other communities. If you see his name and see his book, purchase the book and support his work. It's an excellent book that was written by David Maturo, The Stolen Wealth of Slavery, A Case for Reparation. So until next time, this has been Missing Pages of History. We see you on the 2nd of March.
We are here for all of us. We are. gonna save the nation. With no support for education. Cause right now it don't make sense. Right now it don't make sense. Let's talk about our part. My heart touch your heart. Let's talk about living. Had enough of dying. That's what we all about. Let's do more giving. Do more forgiving. Yeah. Our souls were brought together so that we could love each other. Sister, we are here. We are here.
While we are here,